He seemed like a godsend. He wasn't. That's the concise verdict of the former managing editor, Robert G. Kaiser, on the reign of Amazon founder and billionaire Jeff Bezos as the proprietor of the Washington Post. Robert worked for the Post for half a century, and he wrote about the demise of the Post in the 26 March edition of the New York Review of Books in an essay titled Post Mortem. Robert Kaiser joins us now from New York to follow the money of Jeff Bezos and what it's done at and to the Washington Post. Robert, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad we can do this.
Why did Jeff Bezos say he was taking over the Washington Post, and what changed?
No, it's interesting. As you probably know, the Washington Post was really the modern version created by the Graham family. Katharine Graham was our famous publisher who you've seen, played by Meryl Streep in the movies. She was a terrific character and very courageous, did all the right things. The Grahams just didn't think about the possibility that this business wasn't forever. But then quite suddenly, it wasn't forever. And just at the time I stepped down as the managing editor, we had to realize that there was no more growth. It was going the wrong way. And Katharine Graham's son, Donald Graham, took over from her, and then he passed it on to his niece, also named Katharine, in the late 90s. But the numbers were starting to go south, as we say in American, and things just looked worse and worse. She tried to save the situation by cutting expenses, but cutting expenses on a newspaper is never a secret to economic success. On the contrary, it's almost always a sign of trouble, as it was at the Post. So Don Graham and his niece, Katharine, decided first, without telling anybody else, that they were going to have to sell the paper because they couldn't make it work. And Don Graham had become friendly with Jeff Bezos. And Don Graham approached Bezos and said, "I've got an opportunity for you. How would you like to be the proprietor of the most important paper in the most important city in the most important country in the world?" And he went for it. What the process of those conversations really was, I've never learned. It'll be fun to know how Graham, who's a wonderful character and a good friend of mine, how he sold Bezos on this idea. We can guess, but we don't know. When it was announced, I think it was October 2013, Bezos behaved beautifully. He said all the right things, and he did the right things.
Yes, indeed. And you quote here the formal statement that he made when he took over the paper. And as you say, it's sort of pitch perfect. The values of the Post do not need changing. The paper's duty will remain to its readers and not to the private interests of its owners. We will continue to follow the truth wherever it leads. That sounds pretty good. Is that the way the early years of the Bezos proprietorship actually operated?
Yes. He was generous and totally patient. "I'm going to give you the runway," he said at the only staff meeting he ever held right after he bought it. "I'm going to give you the runway you need for a new takeoff, a new version of the Post. It can live on forever." He knew he had a good editor in Martin Baron. He knew he had a lot of talented journalists, and he just went with it. And for years, he wrote a lot of checks. We don't know how much, because as soon as he bought the Post, it was a private company, and there was no more reporting of profits and losses or any other numbers. He knew the numbers, but we didn't know. But it was clear that he was spending money. He encouraged the newsroom to grow, hire more people. Everything was fine until it wasn't. And what changed is the mystery we all gossip about and don't really know. But Jeff Bezos had a very interesting and dramatic midlife crisis. All of a sudden, his marriage of many, many years to a very gentle and intelligent novelist called Mackenzie Scott blew up. Then he was seen in public with a very brassy dame. Loretta Sanchez was her name, a former Los Angeles TV anchor who was married, in fact, to a good friend of Bezos, and they took up together. It was a very gentle and amicable divorce of the Bezos marriage. He then went off and ordered up what may be the biggest yacht in the world, cost $500 million. I think he's spending $1.5 billion on a sailboat.
Not part of my finance plan at the moment.
But he found a way to do it. Then he realized that wasn't quite enough. He had to spend several hundred more millions for a second yacht that had a helicopter landing pad and could follow around the first yacht everywhere it went. Then he bought a huge mansion in Miami Beach and started being a celebrity rich guy. Showed up with Loretta at all kinds of events that the old Jeff Bezos would never have paid any attention to. And he moved away from Amazon. I don't think we paid enough attention to that fact. He was the founder. He was by far the biggest stockholder. By the early 21st century, his stock was worth more than $200 billion. An unbelievable sum. But he wasn't working at Amazon. He was much more interested in the space company that he, interestingly, just like Elon Musk, decided he had to have. He launched a company that had rockets, sent satellites into space, and so on. He just changed. I don't know the guy. I can't claim to have any psychological insight, but it really changed. And suddenly, not suddenly, but over a pretty short period of time, he began to realize that the Post was more complicated and challenging than he had realized. And one of his first decisions that wasn't so good, he hired a guy to be the publisher, meaning the head of the business, who was not very good, and nobody liked him. After about 8 or 9 years of ownership, I guess, Bezos decided he needed a new publisher. And he asked an associate of his to scour the world and find the best person. This proved to be a very bad process. It ended up with a guy with an Australian connection called Will Lewis, who worked for Rupert Murdoch for many years and was a editor at the Wall Street Journal and a publisher at the Daily Telegraph in London, and a jerk. What can I say? Hope you can't sue me for that in Australia. But he was a terrible choice. He never got to know anybody in the news side of the Post. He brought in a lot of English friends, former colleagues, to run the business side of the Post, who had no idea of the Post's history or place in the world. And they just screwed everything up. It was really a big mess. And they started to lose, I think, pretty serious money.
On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with Robert G. Kaiser, former managing editor of the Washington Post, about his essay, Postmortem, in the New York Review of Books. And Robert, you've referred there to changes in Jeff Bezos's life and perspective, perhaps. But you also mentioned the fact that he said to the Post, I'm going to give you enough runway. Is one explanation for what's happened to the Post that the business model simply didn't turn around, and that at some point Jeff Bezos decided that he couldn't turn it into a viable business?
Yes, that's a reasonable surmise. He hasn't said it, but we know it's true. But here's the problem, Julian, which is hard for you and I to grasp. Jeff Bezos' net worth is approximately $250 billion. It's a stunning number compared to the great rich Americans of earlier times. Rockefeller, Ford, etc. Bezos is vastly, vastly wealthier. He's just got so much money that losing $100 million a year on the Washington Post, which is one number we've heard, we don't know if it's accurate, but that's like you and me losing our lunch money. If you've got $230 billion, count the zeros. I mean, it's just a staggering amount of money.
Yes, I think we can probably all accept the fact that it's not because his pocket's feeling tight that things have changed at the Washington Post.
Exactly. One of the people we got to know at the Post, for example, who was great fun and fascinating, was Warren Buffett, who bought a huge number of shares in the Washington Post without knowing the Grahams or much about it. He just realized that when he did this in the 70s and 80s, the Post had a monopoly position in one of the richest areas of America and was doing smart things to take advantage of it. So Buffett bought all these shares in his great firm, Berkshire Hathaway, and befriended Katharine Graham and Don Graham, became, after the fact of buying a huge quantity of shares, became an important advisor to the Grahams, from whom they learned a lot about business, I think. Anyway, Buffett taught me that even really, really rich people have a really powerful aversion to losses. They hate losses. It's interesting because your Murdoch is an example of someone who learned to live with losses. He's kept the London Times.
And the Australian newspaper, yes, indeed. So, Robert, there's one possible explanation there, just the financial performance of the paper. But as you say, it's clearly not a compelling factor by itself. To what extent do you put the relationship, for better or worse, between Jeff Bezos and Donald Trump down to what's happened recently at the Post?
Well, sadly, I think it's an important factor. It isn't just the personal relationship, which is as phony as any Trump relationship with anyway. You know, if you're Trump's kind of a narcissist, you don't really have relationships. You really push people around and you just deal with them depending on how they react to being pushed around. But Trump has corrupted this country, and it's a tragedy for optimists and romantics like me to watch, but it's undisputable. And he sent the signal to Bezos during his first term that he was not averse, Trump, to using the government to, you know, make personal points and make personal profits. So he told Bezos at one point that the huge contract that Amazon had to provide cloud computer services to the Defense Department, to the Pentagon, for Amazon, cloud computing, it's a huge business and very, very lucrative for Bezos. And it was hundreds of millions a year from the Pentagon. And suddenly, Trump was criticizing the very aggressive coverage that the Post was giving his administration and was sending the signal to Bezos that that money was not guaranteed and that he ordered the Pentagon to relet the contracts for those cloud computing services and let other people bid on them. That was a powerful signal to Bezos and to everybody else that Trump would use the government for such purposes.
And certainly there have been dramatic changes at the Post in recent years. Perhaps you could describe for us the editorial changes that Jeff Bezos has imposed on the Post in the last couple of years, and to the extent you can comment on it, the impact that those changes have had on the business of the Post.
It's important to say and to understand that even with all the bad things that have happened, which we'll talk about in a moment, Bezos has never interfered with the news coverage of the Washington Post. As far as I know, and I think I do know, he's never called an editor to suggest a story or to propose taking a particular approach to an event or anything of that kind. The sort of thing Rupert Murdoch does all the time with his papers, but Bezos didn't do that. And that was good and is good. But he finally changed his policy on the editorial page. I guess you call it the leader page of the Post, which was a liberal, pro-civil rights, outspoken venue for opinion for many, many years. And he called the editor of the editorial page, whom he had helped install in the run-up to the election of 2024, and said just 2 or 3 weeks before Election Day, and having heard Bezos already that his editor and his colleagues had decided that the Post would endorse Kamala Harris against Trump for election, he called up the editor and said, you know, I'm uncomfortable owning a newspaper that tells people how to vote. I'd like you not to publish that editorial. He'd actually seen the draft of the endorsement. The editor understood what was happening and, to his credit, immediately resigned, said, I'm out of here. But this quickly became known, and interestingly and tellingly, more than 200,000 online subscribers to the Washington Post canceled their subscriptions as a result of that decision. And that was a real blow. The Post's circulation sales of the old ink on paper newspaper had been declining in the internet age month after month, but there were 2 million or more paid subscribers online. Part of it was the Post's aggressive coverage of Trump. The Post was known as the Trump bump, bumped up circulation, because it was very popular coverage with anti-Trump Americans, of which there have always been a good number. Anyway, that was the worst thing that happened. Then Will Lewis, the bad publisher, and I guess Bezos too, hired a young man, barely 30 years old, to be the new editor of the editorial page, who turns out to be not very bright or very eloquent and very conservative. And he's really turned off traditional Post readers with his editorials. So there's been more cancellations. We don't know the numbers because they don't release them, but it's bad. They've lost a lot of customers.
And the new policy of the editorial pages, as you said, is now only editorials about personal freedom and free markets. has a Trump-adjacent feel to it. Although, actually, to be honest, the free markets doesn't sound that Trump these days.
Interestingly, that was something Bezos himself announced. Henceforth, he said, all of our editorials will be on those two subjects. In fact, it's not true. There are plenty of other subjects of editorials you can look any day. But the spirit behind that remark, I think, is still at work. Recently, the Post, which had been a leading voice against Senator Joseph McCarthy, the leading American newspaper voice in favor of racial integration and affirmative action and stuff like that, the Post has turned sharply against all of that in recent months. And it's very different and very hard for the old readers to take. People still call me, who I know, and say, is it okay if I cancel my subscription to the Post? I always say, no, don't do it. It doesn't hurt Bezos. Bezos is beyond hurting by the likes of you or me. But it will hurt the hardworking journalists who are still putting out a very good newspaper. There's a very tough story in today's Washington Post about how Trump has really put himself in a terrible corner with this nutty war he's waged, and he's flailing around looking for some way out of it. It's really good journalism, tough, well-reported, interesting, and that is not remotely pro-Trump. It's good American journalism, and there's still a lot of that in the Post. But they went through this paroxysm of cuts and literally cut the news staff in half, wiped out the foreign staff, including a correspondent we had in Australia, and wiped out the sports department, which is just lunatic. Post had the best sports pages of any American newspaper. So the paper that I worked on had about 800 journalists. In the post-Trump bump period, it got up to about 1,200 journalists, and now it's down to 600 and some. Now that's a lot bigger than any newspaper in Australia or London. It's a big staff, but it's very different than it was. And the Post place in the world is much diminished as a result.
Yes, I did want to ask you, Robert, the title of your essay clearly has a good wordplay in it, post-mortem, but it alludes to the death of this grand journalistic institution. In your assessment, can the Washington Post survive and come back from where it is today?
It's a good question, an important question. I guess I should begin by saying that the editors of the New York Review of Books came up with that headline and did not ask my permission to use it.
As is often the way.
It's always the way, almost. And that's fine. It's their right. And I think it's a brilliant headline. It got a lot of attention, but very hard for me to contemplate the death of the Washington Post. I think it's more likely, if Bezos tires of it, that he looks for some other wealthy person who would take it over. But I don't know. But here's the problem. Ink on paper newspapering is fast becoming an historical artifact. Newspapers, as you and I grew up with them, are not going to be here for our great-grandchildren. It's not happening. It's been overtaken. It's a horse carriage of our time. So to survive, the news organizations that newspapers used to support when they were profitable and thriving have got to find a new way to do this. Very interestingly to me, the New York Times appears to have found a path. The New York Times has more paid readers than it's ever had. 4 million, I think, or five. Huge number. Not because of its brilliant foreign correspondence or coverage of Washington, but because of very popular games that people play on the Times website. There's a word game, you probably have it in Australia, called Wordle.
Oh, yes.
Which people love and start their days with. There's also a terrific cooking section with recipes every day and a wonderful archive of recipes, much beloved by American cooks. And it's a big hit. And now they've broken off sports as a separate entity called The Athletic, which appears every day, but you have to pay extra if you want to read the sports. And it's a big success, evidently. So they're okay. They're still growing. Their newsroom is now enormous, and they're thriving. And that tells me that clever and creative management can solve this problem. The problem being, what can you do to make enough money to support an ambitious news operation? But we don't have it at the Washington Post, and Mr. Bezos' skill at selling products from his website wasn't transferable to the news business. Somebody got to come up with another version of what the Times, New York Times, has pulled off.
Robert Kaiser, thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
This was fun.
And Robert G. Kaiser worked at the Washington Post for over 50 years, including as managing editor. And he wrote the essay, although not the headline, of the piece in the New York Review of Books, March edition, Postmortem.